The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Avra Lewis with the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The first article is titled, From Fear to Freedom. A stylist and travel editor opens up about his hair journey and how he learned the power of a good cut. For many kids, hair is a playground, a place for self-expression and experimentation. For me, it was a battlefield, and my mom was the general, armed with practicality, marshaling friends and family far and wide as they used their clippers. Her goal was efficiency. She was a single mother working exhausting hours, doing what she could, and that typically meant finding the cheapest haircut available. For us, that was often the $5 Chinese barber shop down the street. The Chinese barber once gave me some sort of bacterial infection on my scalp. I still have the bald spot. But if I'm being totally honest, almost every haircut I had early on was a disaster. My aunt used to cut my cousin's hair and mine in her bathroom. The experience was excruciating. Hot clippers, jagged lines, and occasional cuts to the skin. My uncle once put a literal bowl on my head and trimmed around it. And my mom's boyfriend, well, he'd eventually become infamous for destroying one of the most important hair moments of my young life. With a record like that, I never saw getting a haircut as something to enjoy. It was something to survive. That changed in second grade. I was 8 years old when my teacher's daughter, who was dating a barber, offered to take me to a black barber shop. It was a small gesture on her part, but it was a monumental shift for me. For the first time ever, I walked away from a chair smiling. The cut was clean, the vibe was affirming, and my edge up was sharp. I remember confessing my love to my crush the very next day after school because I felt just that confident. She ultimately rejected me, but I still felt like the man. After that, hair became something I cared about, which is why, not long after, when my mom's boyfriend cut my hair again before my first day at a new school and ruined my edge up beyond recognition, I wept. I cried the entire night because now I understood what was being taken from me. The feeling of looking like myself, the power of a good cut, the dignity of being seen the way you want to be. I didn't grow up with my dad to teach me the mechanics, and truth be told, being Nigerian, I'm not sure he would have added much value anyway. My uncle was Nigerian too. See the bowl cut? So everything I learned about my hair, I learned the hard way. Like how waves weren't just about brushing. When I was 12, I spent hours dragging a dry brush across my scalp, trying to carve waves into my head like a sculptor, until my hair turned into a crop of bone straight thistle across my head. Then I discovered pomade and overcorrected. My hair was greasy for months, but eventually I figured it out. And when those waves finally showed up, it felt like I had unlocked some secret code, a private joy hard-earned and deeply felt. High school opened the door to reinvention. I experimented with mohawks, flat tops, and as much hair dye as I was allowed. My hair became a revolving diary, a physical manifestation of whatever phase I was in at the time. When I was shopping at Hot Topic, wearing studded belts, and listening to Party Like a Rock Star, a la the 2007 Shop Boys, I had a mohawk. When I was deep into 80s and 90s fashion, I rocked a high flat top. Every style was a response to who I was becoming or wanted to become. Hair was language. It said what I couldn't always afford to say through clothes. It gave me access to style when money did. I've always believed that how you present yourself to the world is a form of preemptive self-belief. Fashion doesn't just help you show who you are, it helps you become the person you're growing into. Hair does the same. You just don't wear it, you wear yourself through it. That belief only deepened as I got older. In a Nigerian household where long hair on boys was practically a sin, the idea of getting braids felt like crossing a forbidden line. I didn't get them until I was 27. Growing up, if I wasn't next to bald, my hair was seen as wild and unruly. So for the first time, I sat in a stylist chair and felt my hair pulled into parts, woven tightly into plaits. It felt like more than a new style. It was a reclamation, a late coming rite of passage I wasn't allowed to have before. Then came the grays. I found my first ones at 25, but by the time I was 28, they had taken over an overwhelmingly amount of real estate. At first, I panicked. After a call with my dad, who told me he was fully gray by the age of 33, it all made sense. The panic turned into pride. This, too, was a style I'd come to wear. A page in the archive, a sign of time, doing what it does best, evolving you. These days, my hair is a sight of freedom. I've done a lot, but Bantu knots are still on the list. I use a lot of sacred because it works, but also because if I'm trusting anyone with my hair, it might as well be Beyonce. I've also become obsessed with beads. As someone who loves jewelry, I feel there is something beautiful about adorning your tresses the same way you do your body. A simple way to add the weight of personality to a style. A small ornament of self woven into my roots. If there's one thing this journey has taught me, it's that style isn't just about aesthetics. It's about becoming. My hair has been a timeline, a mood board, and a trial and error guide to growing into myself, bad haircuts included. It's given me space to experiment, permission to fail, and reasons to smile in the mirror again. All this is proof that what felt like a battlefield became a magnificent canvas. The next article is titled The Business of Being Drewski. From viral skits to sold out stages, this creative is proving that betting on yourself pays off. When I hear about someone's backstory, I can usually pinpoint what the twist in their origin story might be, the moment in time when someone who may have started out good takes a turn toward darkness. It could be an incident or even an internal reflection that puts the person on a journey toward mayhem and, in some cases, destruction. In movies, we saw this with Killmonger in Black Panther and with Harvey Dent in The Dark Knight. Is real life ever that dramatic? Perhaps not, but one can still see clear representations of how such situations can play out. Then there are those who confront similarly harsh experiences, yet manage to stay on the path of light and even draw lessons from their hardships to make future audiences laugh. For comedian and internet personality Drew Desbordes, aka Drewski, I imagine his turn toward darkness could have begun with his high school teacher's words, sitting in class next to a star athlete destined for Division I football. The future comedy mogul listened as his teacher publicly humiliated him in front of his peers. "Don't sit next to Drew," she announced. "He's not going to the same places you're going in life. You need to be sitting over here." For many young black men, those words could have been a verdict. They could have delivered a self-esteem hit that caused irreparable damage to an impressionable teen. Drewski was still figuring how to get around Atlanta, let alone how to make his way through the world. One could write a whole separate piece on how educators can better support creatives pursuing non-traditional careers, but that's a story for another day. Now, over a decade later, Drewski will be headlining his own global comedy tour. It kicks off at London's OVO Arena, Wembley, and features stops at arenas across America. I don't know where that young football player from Drewski's high school is, but he actually could have learned a thing or two by sitting next to Drewski, because that teacher's prediction couldn't have been more wrong. One thing worth noting is that meeting Drewski is the farthest you'd ever actually come from finding a villain. When we spoke, he was kind, charismatic, and one of the most humble celebrities I've met in a long time, especially given the tremendous amount of success he's garnered in a seemingly short amount of time. Drewski isn't just next, he's right now. But that's the thing, he hasn't caught up with all of it quite yet. I'm not going to lie, I'd be mind blown, Drewski says, reflecting on what his teenage self would think of his current success. Back then, he was contemplating dropping out of high school, frustrated by an educational system that seemed to reject him for his natural comedic gifts. "I was going through a crisis," he admits. "I really was. Everything I did, it was wrong in the eyes of the school. By sticking it out, ended up being beneficial because those classmates who laughed at his antics became his audience. Now, with 27 million followers across social platforms, he's something many entertainment executives are fighting to find, a talent who can build loyal audiences with authenticity and integrity. But this man had a plan, even when nobody else could see it. I knew I had a purpose," Drewski says. "Comedy had been on my mind for a long time, and I just kept kind of ignoring it in a way. For me at the time, it had nothing to do with any business behind it. It was just for the love of comedy and just doing it because I felt like it was my purpose. Season 1 of his self-produced YouTube series, Could Have Been House, pulled 58 million views across 8 episodes. Season 2, featuring appearance from Little Baby, Rick Ross, and Kevin Hart, continued this momentum. His dating show, Could Have Been Love, hit 80 million total views across 7 episodes. That's an average of 11.4 million views per episode, which in today's era of short attention spans and moving on to the next big thing seems astronomical. And the best part about it? Every single one of those views came after Hollywood told him no. We tried to get Netflix. We tried to get Amazon. We tried to get Hulu, Drewski says. We tried to get a lot of companies to believe in the short form shows. Everything was a no. Back to back to back to back to back. Most people would have taken that as a sign to pivot or even to compromise their initial vision to fit what industry executives said they wanted to see. But Drewski saw it differently. I started saying, all right, if I believe in myself this much and I've made it this far believing in myself, what if I take the money I'm getting from some of these companies that are paying me and start to make my own productions? And that's exactly what he did. If he couldn't find a way, he was going to make one. Ultimately, he spent what totaled millions of his own dollars on For Lifers Entertainment, while other newly wealthy entertainers were buying chains and cars, Drewski was building a production company. My first big purchase was reinvesting in myself, for sure, he says. His lifestyle reflects this philosophy in ways that would probably confuse a lot of people in his tax bracket, especially after they've touched the first big check. I wear Birkenstocks and Patagonia, or camouflage shirts and baseball jerseys, he says with a laugh when I ask what he did when he came into his first bit of money after seeing some success. I don't even have a watch right now. I need to actually go get a watch. Only a person who has been at the bottom could understand this mentality and the kind of hustle and grind that keep him going. As we have established that he didn't learn it in school or in a textbook, he was determined to make it, and the only way he knew of to do so was to study both the wins and the spectacular losses of the entertainment business. I tend to watch a lot of real-life documentaries, he says. I would study the failures and the good things about the people I looked up to, even if they might have been somebody who was once famous but fell off. Talk about a smart move. The entertainment graveyard is full of people who made the wrong choices with their money and their brands. Drewski figured if he was going to avoid those mistakes, he needed to understand exactly how those same people crashed and burned. One of the biggest and perhaps hardest lessons he had to master, learning when to say no, even when the money was tempting. Because, boy, did some of those offers sound good. I always look to make sure it is something that's on brand for everything that I'm doing, he explains. I am not going to work with a great company and then go work with a BS company just because the money's crazy. Trust me, we have been offered a lot of money for some wild deals. The temptation is real. When you are looking at life-changing money, it's hard to think about long-term brand damage. But Drewski has seen what happens to creators who chase every check. It's good in the moment for the people that do it, he reflects, but in the long run, you just see the downfall of it over time. Years later, you're like, oh man, what happened to the people that once believed in me? Where did they go? Enter Kevin Hart, who became both mentor and collaborator after recognizing something in Drewski that maybe even Drewski didn't, at the time, fully see. Hart's influence on his business approach has been huge, particularly around the importance of relationships over money grabs. The main piece of advice that he gave me and Kai, Twitch streamer Kai Sinet, is to just make sure that we are doing it right, Drewski says. You are going to go through no's, but just find a yes out of the no's. He is relentless. Hart's emphasis on patience and relationship building is something Drewski took to heart. It's not just about money, money, money. It's more about relationships. You can make a room full of people laugh, but do you have the same relationships with some of the people that can put you in a greater position? I'll be the first to admit his joint effort with Hart and Sinet is the type of content that I and the internet didn't know we all needed, especially during these crazy times. And that undeniable material has produced viral content and now a feature film, with all three contributors maintaining their individual brands while creating something bigger together. Everybody pulls their own weight in the trio that we have, says Drewski. You don't see too many people that are able to work together well and naturally just be funny together. And that is just one piece of Drewski's larger pie. His real power moves come in the form of transforming his brand deals into something bigger instead of just taking checks from major companies for Lifers Entertainment, partners with them as a legitimate production house. When we did the Google commercial for Lifers, collabed with Google on that production, Drewski explains, or when we do any of my Nike commercial stuff, we collab with them, with my production company. Now we have gotten to a point where it is a little bit more respected than it was when I just had to believe in myself. His content philosophy is simple but effective. Never repeat yourself. Always evolve. I don't try to do anything twice, and I try not to get my fan base bored of anything that I do, he says. Each skit needs to feel fresh, and his characters work because they are pulled from real observations. People watch and think, I know exactly that type of person. Staying grounded when your life changes this dramatically requires intentional choices. Drewski was given opportunities to relocate to Los Angeles. He tried it for 6 months and hightailed it back to Atlanta. I didn't feel down to earth, he says, and if I don't feel down to earth, I can't give the world the best of me because the biggest thing about me is being relatable. That relatability is what separates him from other comedians. His characters work because people recognize them, and that's probably because we have all met these people in real life. Though I did tell Drewski, I can't believe some of the people that he's parroting in these skits actually go along with this. His maintaining that connection to regular folks is probably why his international fan base has grown so quickly. Which brings us to what might be his most ambitious project yet, the Coulda Fest Tour, launching September 13th at OVO Arena Wembley the day after his birthday, because why not make it personal? This arena tour is a major scale up from his previous theater shows. It will feature a hybrid format that mixes comedy and music with guests including Soulja Boy and Young M.A., plus special appearances from Snoop Dogg and Little Yachty. It's a mixture of something that you really haven't seen before. A 50-50 blend of music and comedy, Drewski states. The concept proved successful when the original Coulda Fest at Atlanta's State Farm Arena sold out, featuring appearances from Kay Sinet, 21 Savage, and Glorilla, and Meek Mill. It's safe to say I'll be there with bells and whistles on, and so should you, because in an industry where creatives usually sacrifice ownership for opportunity, Drewski found another path, betting everything on his vision and working until everyone else had no choice but to believe in it too. We believe, as it turns out, the business of being Drewski is just the business of being authentically yourself and smart enough to turn that authenticity into an empire. The next article is titled Essence Festival of Culture. The 2025 Essence Festival of Culture, presented by Coca-Cola, wasn't just a weekend. It was a homecoming, a family reunion, and a celebration, all rolled into one. Made Like This came alive everywhere you looked, in the Superdome concerts that energized the city, in the panels that sparked new ideas, and in the joy of the community spilling into every corner of New Orleans. 31 years in, the festival kept proving what we already know. We show up, we shine, and we set the culture. For your exclusive guide to all things Essence Fest, download the E360 app. Unlock the full festival experience with the E360 app, your digital key to all the excitement. Whether you're joining us in New Orleans or connecting from anywhere in the world, why you'll love the E360 app. You can stay connected anywhere. Experience the festival magic in person or virtually. We've got you covered. Paperless entry. Your digital badge is now right at your fingertips. No printing. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Avery Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.